Okay, we got a pretty good full show for you today, and we're going to start off with something I think you'll really enjoy. Dave, do we have you online?
Hello there.
Hello, Dave Lippman.
I'm there.
All right. You're there. I'm here. Let's go.
I'm in my undisclosed location.
Oh, very good, very good. Okay, you are a satirical songster, and you are going to put on a benefit for a very important organization down in Sacramento. And that organization is Soapbox, which is Sacramento's only progressive TV talk show, Channel 17, Mondays at 8 p.m. So you're going to put on a benefit for them, and what you going to do?
Well, of course, they're putting me on, and I'm putting them on, so it's all mutual, you know, it's kind of a partnership between the artiste, alleged artiste, and the actual community, which is the model I've used just lately for the last 27 years in my performances, is just work together with the locals. Doesn't have so much to do with the venue, although I hear it's very nice, California Stage.
Okay. And for the next 20 minutes or so, I want you to put us on.
All right, we'll never know what hit us.
There you go. Now, you have a few alter egos, do you not?
Well, in the past, I've been much more skitzed out than I am now. I'm down to about two, but I reckon that everybody is, and I'm just the one that admits it on stage. But in the past, people have mostly known me for the singing CIA agent George Shrub that I presented, whose character was much more developed than mine, I had to admit. But he took powder and went back into the cold or some other undisclosed place when the president, the boy wonder president, evaporated out of there after 8 years. So he's all done. And then George Stump was the moderate clear cutter, and he was around for a little while. And then Seymour, the yuppie, dumpy, formerly downwardly mobile urban post-professional, and they're all gone and replaced by Wild Bill Bailout, the bard of the bankers, who will be leading off the charge on the show this Saturday.
You want to give us a flavor of Wild Bill Bailout? Before you get into that, let me say that this benefit is... when's the benefit? Saturday evening. It is Saturday, January 16th. There's two shows at 3 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. And ticket information, tickets are at the bookseller, or you can phone 916-444-3203. Okay, you want to give us a flavor of Wild Bill Bailout?
Hello, Dave just put me on the line as Wild Bill Bailout, the Bard of the Bailers, and I'm here to do a little legal consulting with you. Well, almost legal consulting with you.
Almost legal.
Yes.
Important distinction.
I actually work with the consulting firm of Geithner and Bailout, and we are doing all kinds of good work to protect the economy from you folks, or vice versa. Not sure. Did you have a question for me there?
Yeah. How come the bailout seems to be costing the taxpayers tons, and the wealthy bankers seem to be getting more bonuses and recording record profits? Could you explain that, please?
Of course, that's a function of the age-old trickle-down system, the trickle-down philosophy, as exuberated and exonerated by Jesus, as you may know. I don't know if you know this, but trickle-down was a function of the original nuclear family that was founded right after the Earth in Kansas 6,000 years ago. But anyway, we've been criticized for this because, of course, they say that if you're too big to fail, then you're the right size to nationalize. But, of course, that would be socialism, and since they have a socialist president now, I suppose that's what they're going to do in the end. And then you'll be sorry, and then you'll stop blaming me, I suppose. But people have been saying that we should be bailing out the needy, not the greedy, and most of the people who have said that are in custody.
That's an interesting coincidence there.
Well, yes, these things just do roll along to where people get their just desserts, and the banksters get the dinner, actually. It's quite a tradition, blaming the rich. You know, so somebody high up in the government once said, the poor of the earth have always wanted to plunder the rich, and they persist in that.
They persist in trying, but they don't seem to ever succeed at that.
No. Well, you know, Darwin explained very well that you have to be fit, and fit as a fiddle, to survive these things. And the people who survive, I mean, the poor will always be with us, and that should be their victory. They're never going away. I mean, unless they get rich, of course, but that would be genocide against the poor, wouldn't it? Causing them to become something else. That would be ethnic cleansing. We're not about to do that.
No, certainly not.
No. But we're very happy with... I know people have been upset about the bonuses. $39 billion, I think it was, after they lost $74 billion of well, your money, frankly. But if you folks out there can afford it, because, well, let's face it, you got no house payments. So.
That's true. We don't have any health payments to make. You know, that's an interesting phrase you use. You said that they lost $74 million. You don't really lose money, do you? It just goes somewhere else.
No, no, it's just that they have so many different houses that they can't remember which mattress they put it in.
Oh,
I know it's kind of funny for bankers to be keeping their money in mattresses, and I wasn't supposed to say that publicly, so I don't know how long your radio station will be. Oh, yes, we have an interceptor in the line, so nobody actually heard that.
Oh, good. Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Okay, what else, when you're down in Sacramento on the 16th, what else are you going to talk about?
Well, as we know, the California economy has come up a little short from being the sixth largest economy in the world, larger than most nations, and now cannot pay for its schools. So we are thinking of annexing California right into the United States, but don't tell anyone that. A lot of other people down south have been trying to get out, actually. They're seceding again. But we're thinking of taking on California and see if we can't incorporate it back in. Of course, we know what has ruined California is those radical environmental standards, because as we know, the ecology always grows into the economy, so we can pretty well see, you know, the failure to drill baby drill off of Santa Barbara is where it really all started, and then this all these wind turbines in the Bay Area and all this kind of environmental stuff that pollutes the economy. So we're going to see what we can't do to straighten that out. Even if we have to nationalize it, it'll just be a sort of a temporary side door, not socialism, but, you know, side door, kind of a national sort of a socialism.
Ah, yes. And everything the government does is only temporary.
Right. Well, it's a temporary life, you know. No one gets out alive. And I hope people appreciate that. We'll see what we can do for California.
Okay, and I'm sure they will. All right, then. So you're going to be at the... I wish I could read my own writing. You're going to be somewhere in Sacramento.
California Stage, 2509 R Street. I think R stands for railroad. It's right down by the tracks there.
Okay, 2509 R Street in Sacramento. There's going to be two shows. One is at 3 p.m., the other is at 7:30 p.m. This is Saturday, January 16th. It's a benefit for a very important cause, and that is Sacramento's only progressive TV talk show, Channel 17, Mondays at 8. It's called Soapbox.
And we'll be having some music. I don't just run my mouth. I do some nice song that I do, Brother, Can You Spare a Diamond? That's the story of the sad broker and his cousin, Diamond Monger, who went broke, and all the poor people that came to their rescue.
Oh, okay.
Geithner fit the battle at Goldman Sachs, and we got quite a number of numbers is what we got.
Well, before we let you go, are you prepared to sing one of them now?
Let me see if I can think on it. The once I built a mortgage, made it run against prime. Once I built a mortgage, now it's done. Brother, can you say subprime? Once in shark skin suits, gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee doodly don't. Half a million souls went into debt hell. I was the cat with the loan. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al, Tim, Larry, and yes, Tim. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal, brother. Can you spare a diamond? I won't tell you how it comes out.
Terrific. All right, Dave, thank you very much, and good luck in your show.
We'll see you soon.
All right. You have a great afternoon. Bye-bye. All right, that was Dave Lippman. He is performing down in Sacramento on the 16th of January. If you're interested in tickets, you can get them at the Book Collector or by phoning 916-444-3203. All right, it is now it's about 18 minutes after. My commentary for today, January 13th. Well, are you ready for another war? Can you find Yemen on a map? Your friends and relatives in the military may be getting an all-expense-paid vacation there shortly. That is, if they aren't sent to Pakistan instead. President Peace Prize. How we misunderestimated you. Next item. Email originally from someone named Tom Condit. Since we still seem to be having a national freakout over some loser who got on an airplane with a bomb in his underwear, which was apparently worthy of a presidential address, It might be a good idea to put the actual danger posed by terrorists attacking in some numerical perspective. If you count the Fort Hood shooting as a terrorist attack, in 2009, 16 people have died in the United States as a result of terrorism. The other three deaths include the Little Rock Military Recruiting Office shooting, one died, the Holocaust Museum shooting, one died, and Dr. George Tiller's assassination, one died, the last two coming at the hands of not Muslims, but good old right-wing extremists. On the other hand, 45,000 Americans died because they didn't have health insurance, and 600 died from salmonella poisoning. Clearly, providing health care to all Americans is beyond our capabilities. So when do we launch the $700 billion war on salmonella? Next item. Here's a modest suggestion for clearing up our mess of a government. It seems that our elected representatives don't really represent us. If not corrupt when elected, the system soon corrupts them. What's the greatest fear of any elected official? Answer, not getting reelected. It's one of the cushiest jobs on the planet, and they don't want to lose it. And in our present system, it takes money to get reelected. Lots and lots of money. Can you see where this is leading? So when it comes time for them to vote on any issue, they seldom, if ever, vote their conscience, or they're even less likely to vote what their constituents desire. Their vote is determined by what their major contributors want. My solution is to make the job less desirable. Make the job one of service to the people, rather than a lifetime place at the feeding trough of public largesse. How do we achieve that? Firstly, cut the perks. They get the same medical and dental insurance as the rest of us. No more, no less. No more private jets at taxpayers' expense. They can fly first class on commercial airlines. There's scores of other perks we can do away with. But the single most important change would be to impose severe term limits. One term and out would be ideal, but it's impractical. So give them two terms. That's it. That alone would return the entire system to citizens representing their fellow citizens, rather than career politicians serving whomever bribes them the most. And to those who bleat that we need the experience of professional, i.e. career politicians, I reply, really? Are you satisfied with their efforts so far? Time for a real change to our system. In light of that, I got an email. I haven't had time to check the validity of this. I don't know who originally wrote it. If someone can research this and call in by the end of this show, terrific. But I'm going to read it. According to the trustees for the Social Security Administration, there will not be a cost of living increase for the next 2 years in Social Security benefits. Additionally, they'll raise your copay for your prescription Medicare benefits. They, the Congress, both Republican and Democrats together, say no increase is warranted because of the losses in gross national product and other cute things. Now, sports fans, this is one that'll flip you out. The Social Security Administration is funding $24 million. Let me repeat that so you understand it. $24 million for new electronic medical records processing for our congressmen and senators. They're obtaining these funds, and I quote directly from the Social Security website, quote, "This money will be coming from the savings to be generated from withholding cost of living increases for 2010 and 2011 in Social Security benefits for the elderly, and a $2 increase on all Medicare prescription benefit copay. Please pass this on to all your friends and have them protest to the idiots who we elected to Congress, who, by the way, have just voted themselves another 3% salary increase. We must put a stop to this outright thievery. It's the Congress and the Senate, both Republican and Democrats. We can't fire them, but we can sure as hell not re-elect them. And we can impeach them or demand recall elections. How about we all get together and dump these clowns? Just watch. They'll spend this money and find the software doesn't work, dump the whole thing and go back to the old steam-driven system just like they did with air traffic control several years ago. Don't worry, though. They've got health care all worked out. So here's what we can do. The entire Congress of the United States is corrupt, and I mean both houses, and I mean both major parties. I realize that a few members of each house are trustworthy, but as a group, they're absolutely the most corrupt bunch to ever disgrace our nation. In November of 2010, the entire House of Representatives will stand for re-election. all 435 of them. One-third of the Senate, a total of 33 of them, will also stand for re-election. Vote every incumbent out. And I mean every one of them, no matter their party affiliation. Let's start all over in the House of Representatives with 435 people who have absolutely no experience in running that body, with no political favors owed to anyone but their own constituents. Let's make them understand that they work for us. They're answerable to us, and they simply have to run that body with some common sense. 2 years later, in 2012, vote the next third of the incumbents in the Senate out. We can do the same thing in 2014, and by that time we'll put all new people in that body as well. We the people have got to take this country back and have to do it peacefully. That's what the framers of our Constitution envisioned. I'm also suggesting term limits on the new bunch at 8 years for representatives and 12 years for senators. No exemptions. The longer they stay in office, the more power they get, and they love it, and they'll do anything to get reelected. We have term-limited the president, now let's term-limit the legislators. Vote the power abusers out. Let's take America back. Again, I don't know where that came from, and I don't know the factuality of this guy's comments on Social Security. All right, this one is by Richard Clark. It was in opednews.com. Big banks bundled toxic debt and sold it to rubes, then bet against it and won big. Mr. Eagle, the new managing director at Goldman Sachs, has risen to prominence inside his company by creating a program that was at first intended to protect Goldman from investment losses if the housing market collapsed. However, as the market did in fact start heading for collapse, it became apparent to Goldman what was about to take place. And so they greatly expanded this program, enabling the company to pocket huge profits at considerable cost to others. As we all know by now, pension funds and insurance companies lost billions of dollars buying toxic but highly rated securities, which they had good reason to believe were good, solid investments. Goldman was, of course, not the only firm that peddled these toxic securities, known as synthetic collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, and then made financial bets against them, selling them short, called selling short in Wall Street parlance. Other banks that created similar toxic securities and then bet they would fail include Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley, as well as smaller firms like Tricadia Incorporated, an investment company whose parent firm was overseen by Louis A. Sachs, who this year, perhaps rather significantly, became a, quote, special counselor to Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. How these disastrously performing toxic securities were devised and with what ultimate purpose or plan is now the subject of scrutiny by investigators in Congress, at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and at the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which is Wall Street's self-regulatory organization. Those involved with these inquiries declined to comment. While these investigations are in the early phases, authorities are supposedly looking at whether securities laws or rules of fair dealing were violated by firms that created and sold these toxic mortgage-linked debt instruments, and then bet against the clients who purchased them. But given the blindness that the SEC exhibited with regard early and plentiful evidence that Bernie Madoff was operating a Ponzi scheme, and given the amount of money Wall Street contributes to the re-election campaigns of various members of Congress, don't hold your breath. The central question within these inquiries is, allegedly, whether or not the firms creating these toxic securities purposely helped to select especially risky mortgage-linked assets that would be most likely to crater, setting their clients up to lose billions of dollars if the housing market imploded. Indeed, some securities packaged by Goldman and Tricadia ended up being so vulnerable that they went bad within a 2 or 3 months of being created. The evidence seems to be strong that Goldman and the other firms used the CDOs to place unusually large negative bets, i.e. bets against their duped customers, which obviously put the firms at odds with their own clients' interests. Quote, the selling of securities to customers and then shorting them because these companies believed the securities were going to default is the most cynical misuse of credit information that I've ever seen, close quote, by Sylvain R. Raines, an expert in structural finance at R&R Consulting in New York. Quote, when you buy protection against an event that you've had a hand in causing, you're buying fire insurance on someone else's house and then committing arson. A handful of investors and Wall Street traders clearly anticipated the mortgage crises. In 2006, Wall Street had introduced a new index called the ABX, which essentially became a betting parlor in which one could bet on the direction mortgage securities were going to go. The index allowed traders to bet on or against pools of mortgages with different risk characteristics, just as stock indexes enable traders to bet on whether the overall stock market or technology stocks or bank stocks will go up or down. Goldman, among others on Wall Street, has admitted that since the collapse, it made big money by using the ABX to bet against the housing market. Worried about the housing bubble, top Goldman executives decided in 2006 to change the firm's overall stance on the mortgage market from positive to negative. However, it did not disclose that to their customers. Why tip off the rubes you were about to fleece? Beginning in 2004, with housing prices soaring and the mortgage mania in full swing, Goldman's managing director had begun creating CDO deals within a betting parlor known as Abacus. From 2004 to 2008, Goldman issued 25 Abacus deals, according to Bloomberg, with a total value of $10.9 billion. The Abacus betting parlor allowed investors to bet for or against the mortgage securities that were linked to the deal. These CDOs didn't contain actual mortgages. Instead, they consisted of credit default swaps, a type of insurance that pays out when a borrower defaults. These swaps made it much easier to place large bets on mortgage failures. I've got a phone call, but you're going to have to wait a couple of minutes while I finish this article. Please be patient. Goldman's directors saw the writing on the wall in this market as early as 2005. By creating the Abacus CDOs, they not only helped protect Goldman against losses that others would suffer, they allowed Goldman to profit handsomely on those losses. Just 5 months after Goldman had sold off a new Abacus CDO, the rating on 84% of the mortgages underlying it had been downgraded, indicating growing concerns about borrowers' ability to repay the loans. This is according to research from UBS, the big Swiss bank. Of the more than 500 CDOs analyzed by UBS, only two were worse for gullible investors than the Abacus deals. Consider also an $800 million CDO betting parlor known as Hudson Mezzanine. It included credit insurance on mortgages and subprime mortgage bonds that were in the ABX index. Hudson buyers would make money if the housing market stayed healthy, but lose money if it collapsed. Goldman kept a significant amount of the financial bets against securities in Hudson, so that Goldman would profit if they failed. This according to three of the former Goldman employees involved in this scheme. A Goldman salesman involved in Hudson said the deal was one of the earliest in which outside investors raised questions about Goldman's unethical strategies. Quote, here we are selling this stuff, but we think the market's going to go the other way, he said, with no further comment. Okay, that's the end of the article. My comment. I've said this before, but it bears repeating. If this were to have taken place in England, those culpable would have retired in disgrace. If it had happened in China, those culpable would be summarily shot. But it happened in America, where rapacious capitalism is the ruling religion, so the culprits are rewarded with government positions and fat bonuses paid for by the suckers. Now, is that capitalism, or is it socialism for the very wealthy? I don't know, but what I do know is that you and I are on the wrong end of this equation. The taxpayer is paying for it. Okay, I'm done with the article, and the caller has hung up, so try again. The time, 12:32 in the p.m., the radio station, KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamberlain. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. And we're going to prattle on for another 25 minutes. And by the way, this is my last time on the air for 3 months. I'm taking off for 3 months. This one's by James Ridgway, Mother Jones Online. You know, I'm fascinated by the fact that people phone while I'm reading an article and don't hang on till the end of the article. Mystifies me. Who's Getting Rich from the Naked Full Body Scanner Boom by James Ridgway, Mother Jones Online. Scan, baby, scan. That's the mantra amongst politicians at all levels in the wake of the thwarted terrorist attack aboard a Detroit-bound passenger jet. According to conventional wisdom, the would-be underwear bomber could have been stopped by airport security if he'd been put through a full-body scanner, which would have revealed the cache of explosives attached to Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab's groin. Within days or even hours of the bombing attempt, everyone was talking about so-called whole-body imaging as the magic bullet that could stop this type of attack. In announcing hearings by the Senate Homeland Security Committee, Joe Lieberman approached the use of scanners as a foregone conclusion, saying one of the, quote, big, urgent questions that we're holding this hearing to answer was, why isn't whole-body scanning technology that can detect explosives in wider use? Former Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff told the Washington Post, you got to find some way of detecting things in parts of the body that aren't easy to get at. It's either pat-downs or imaging, or otherwise hoping that bad guys haven't figured it out. And I guess bad guys have figured it out. You got to love Michael Chertoff. He gives the best quotes since King George W. Bush. Back to the article. Since the alternative is being groped by airport screeners, the scanners might sound pretty good. The Transportation Security Administration has claimed that the images are friendly enough to post in a preschool, though the pictures themselves tell another story, and numerous organizations have opposed them as a gross invasion of privacy. Beyond privacy issues, however, are questions about whether these machines really work and about who stands to benefit most from their use. When it comes to high-tech screening methods, the TSA has a dismal record of enriching private corporations with failed technologies, and there are signs that the latest miracle device might just bring more of the same. Known by their opponents as digital strip search machines, the full-body scanners use one of two technologies, millimeter wave sensors or backscatter X-rays, to see through clothing, producing ghostly images of naked passengers. Yet critics say that these two are highly fallible and are incapable of revealing explosives hidden in body cavities, an age-old method for smuggling contraband. If that's the case, a terrorist would hide the entire bomb works within his or her body and breeze through the virtual strip search undetected. Yesterday, the London Independent reported on authoritative claims that officials at the United Kingdom Department for Transport and the Home Office have already tested the scanners and were not persuaded that they would work comprehensively against terrorist threats to aviation. Close quote. A British defense research firm reportedly found the machines unreliable in detecting low-density materials like plastics, chemicals, and liquids, precisely what the underwear bomber had stuffed in his briefs. Yet the rush toward full-body scans already seems unstoppable. They were mandated today as part of the enhanced screening for travelers from selected countries, and hundreds of the machines are already on order at a cost of about $150,000 apiece. Within days of the bombing attempt, Reuters was reporting that the, quote, greatest U.S. government shift toward using the high-tech devices could create a boom for makers of security imaging products, and it has already created a speculative spike in share prices in some companies. Which brings us to the money shot. The body scanner is sure to get a go-ahead because of the illustrious personages hawking them. Chief amongst them is former Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, who now heads the Chertoff Group, which represents one of the leading manufacturers of whole-body imaging machines, RapiScan Systems. For days after the attack, Chertoff made the rounds of the media, promoting the scanners, calling the bombing attempt a very vivid lesson in the value of that machinery, all without disclosing his relationship to RapiScan. According to the Washington Post, Chertoff's advocacy for the technology dates back to his time in the Bush administration. In 2005, Homeland Security ordered the government's first batch of the scanners, five from California-based RapiScan Systems. Today, 40 body scanners are in use at 19 U.S. airports. The number is expected to skyrocket, at least in part, because of the Christmas Day incident. The Transportation Security Administration this week said it will order 300 more machines. Remember, that's at a cost of $150,000 each. In the summer, TSA purchased 150 machines from RapiScan with $25 million in American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds. The Washington Examiner last week ran down an entire list of all the former Washington politicians and staff members who are now part of what is called the full-body scanner lobby. One manufacturer, according to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, is American Science and Engineering. AS&E has retained the K Street firm Wexler & Walker to lobby for federal deployment of a security technology. Individual lobbyists on this account include former TSA Deputy Administration Tom Blank, who also worked under House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Chad Wolf, former Assistant Administrator for Policy at TSA, and a former aide to K. Bailey Hutchison, who is a top Senate appropriator and the ranking Republican on the Transportation Committee. She's also lobbying on AS&E's behalf. There's a bunch. Former Senator Al D'Amato from New York represents L3 Systems, about which Bloomberg wrote today. L3 has developed a more sophisticated system that could prevent smuggling of almost anything on the body. And this was spoken by an analyst who has a hold rating on the stock. In forecasting the fate of the full-body scanners, we can turn to recent history, which saw the rapid rise and decline of the previous miracle screening technology. In the years following 9/11, dozens of explosive trace portals, ETPs, were installed in airports across the country at a cost of about $160,000 each. These puffer machines, so-called because they blow air on passengers to dislodge explosive particles, were once celebrated as the no-touch pat-down. But in a Denver test by CBS in 2007, a network employee was sprayed with explosives and then walked through the airport's three puffers without any trouble. The machines also set off false alarms, and they frequently broke down, leading to sky-high maintenance costs. After spending more than $30 million on the puffer machines, most of them purchased from General Electric, the TSA announced early this year that it was suspending their use. Only about 25% of the machines were ever even deployed at U.S. airports. A report last month from the Government Accountability Office found that TSA had not adequately tested the puffers before buying them. What will happen if the full-body scanner goes the way of the puffer? Well, there's always the next generation of security equipment, the Body Orifice Security Scanners, or BOSS, chair. This contraption, which has an uncomfortable resemblance to an electric chair, is used in prisons, mostly in the United Kingdom, for tracing cell phones, shivs, and other dangerous contraband that's been swallowed or inserted into body cavities by inmates. So far, it only detects metal, but you never know. Give me a friendly German Shepherd any day. That was Who's Getting Rich from the Naked Full Body Scanner Boom. It's by James Ridgway, writing in Mother Jones Online. We did a show recently on chemtrails. Here's an update or further thing. Actually, this was written in 2004. It was written by Jim Mars, who some of you may know. He's an investigative reporter, written quite a few books on a wide range of subjects. Chemtrails, covert immunization program or surplus population reduction. For more than 3 years now, I've heard widespread reports of aircraft leaving cross-hatching chemical trails in the sky. Being a former award-winning aviation writer, I initially wrote these stories off as reports from persons unaccustomed to the common vapor trails left in the wake of high-flying aircraft. But now I'm not so sure. The other morning, from my front porch, I watched as several jet aircraft, at least two running parallel, created tic-tac-toe patterns in an otherwise cloudless North Texas sky. I would estimate these craft at somewhere around 20,000 feet. The trail spread outward, blended, and within 2 hours had created a hazy cloud cover with only occasional patches of blue sky. By afternoon, I was wheezing and experiencing a shortness of breath. Most interesting was yet another jet at a much higher altitude, no less than 30,000 feet, which also led a sharply defined condensation, also left a sharply defined condensation or vapor trail. In this case, however, the trail dissipated and totally disappeared as expected from evaporation in low humidity of North Texas. This was a true vapor trail. But what about the lower ones? This experience brought home to me the claims of many people across the country who have reported large military-type aircraft leaving crossed trails which blend together into a cirrus cloud, cover, and settled earth. Such reports have been coming in from all over the continental 48 states for more than 3 years now, and some of the stories I've heard come to mind. One came from a producer friend who early in 1999 stood on a Hollywood set and watched a large tanker plane made several trips up and down the California coast, leaving a trail which coalesced into hazy cloud which drifted over Los Angeles. This was clearly not a normal point A to point B flight. Another story came from a retired police and military pilot in Oklahoma who witnessed KC-135 and KC-10 military aircraft crisscrossing the sky near his home in mid-January. Later he became ill and learned from his doctor that the local hospitals were overflowing with patients suffering from flu-like symptoms. Checking with his former National Guard unit, this man was told that no one knew anything about the craft and their trails, but that they'd been ordered not to fly in the area of the craft on the days in question. Even more worrisome was the report from the owner of a large funeral home near Dallas-Fort Worth, who said deaths this February were twice as high as the same time last year, with no signs of waning. Most of these were elderly people suffering from respiratory ailments. Doctors report an increased number of respiratory ailments, and one pharmacist I know told me he'd not seen such widespread respiratory problems in his more than 30 years of experience. Washington reporter Mike Blair wrote in January of that year that what has been dubbed chemtrails is actually antibacteriological warfare chemicals being tested by the federal government. Some of Blair's sources told him that the covert spraying is being conducted by the Super-Secret Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA, a charge the agency's director has denied. Considering the objections raised by members of the U.S. military, who last year were ordered to undergo anthrax inoculations coupled with a prospect of public panic, it's been theorized that the government is attempting to covertly immunize, and the editor corrects actually infect. So it's been theorized that the government is attempting to covertly either immunize or infect the general population. It's been reported that this program gained its legality from U.S. Code Title 50, Section 1520, which gives the Secretary of Defense authority to order testing involving the use of a chemical agent or biological agent on a civilian population for research purposes. But this theory fails when the government composition, when the chemical composition of the chemtrails is considered. Last April, samples from these chemtrails were analyzed by a facility in Victoria, British Columbia, which is licensed by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and found the chemtrails to contain, in addition to JP-8 jet fuel, which is possibly the carrier medium, which contains the additive ethylene dibromide, banned as a pesticide due to causing severe respiratory reactions, even at low levels, but it also contained numerous pathogens and disease-causing agents. These include, I'm not going to try and read that one, which not only causes respiratory infection, but also attacks the immunization system. Serratia marcellescens, an antibiotic-resistant bacteria which causes pneumonia, endocarditis and meningitis, as well as streptomyces and molds causing capable of inducing heart disease, upper respiratory, and gastrointestinal ailments. Could this covert program be behind the Nile flu and other respiratory outbreaks which reportedly are resisting normal treatment? And what is its true purpose? It seems clear that if this toxic stew of pathogens is intended as an immunization, the cure might be worse than the cause. And when in history has an entire population been unknowingly poisoned by its own leaders while footing the bill for such an outrage? And don't look to the corporate-owned mass media or this year's crop of presidential hopefuls to give us any answer to these questions. They're too busy verbally attacking each other bashing the Second Amendment, and arguing over the Confederate battle flag in South Carolina. You know, all those major issues. That was written back in 2004, but it might give some insight into what's going on in our skies. This one is called A Jew Takes on Obama, Takes Obama Apart, Obama and the Left. Tikkun, a bimonthly Jewish and interfaith magazine founded and edited by Rabbi Michael Lerner that has published cutting-edge critiques of politics, culture, and society since 1986, had the following to say. The left's critique of Obama does not rest on the health plan, Afghanistan, the irresponsible handing over of the U.S. checkbook to the banks, the choice of right-wing economic advisors when so many left-liberal economists were available, e.g. Stiglitz, Krugman, Jeffrey Sachs, the refusal to investigate torture, as the U.S. is required to do, the emphasis on cutting entitlements rather than advancing justice, the cultivation of figures like David Brooks and other centrist rightists, the insistence that passing legislation requires 60 votes, actually it requires 51 plus defeating a filibuster, i.e. allowing the vote, the fig leaf dishonesty on climate change, the no-toing to Netanyahu, the increasing militarization, and so many other things are at stake. On the contrary, Obama has not used the presidency as a bully pulpit. He has not capitalized on his extraordinary victory, one of the greatest Democratic Party victories in the 20th century. He has not mobilized the mandate he received and the energized movement he inspired. He's not built on the widespread perception that the outgoing system. He is not built on the widespread perception that the. Obama has not built on the widespread perception that the outgoing system, which is aggressively neoliberal markets, aggressive militarization, was completely discredited, and that a genuinely new direction was needed. On the contrary, he breathed new life into the right by adopting their language and cultivating their representatives. He's turned off all the young people and the idealists who followed him seeking a change in the mindset of American politics. He would have people out in the street risking their lives for him if he spoke for principle, but he does not. My comment. He does often speak for principle. The problem is that he never acts on his espoused principles. Have we ever had a leader who less walked his talk? All right, let's go to an article by Mark Morford of the San Francisco Gate, which is the new name, I guess, for the San Francisco Chronicle. When Scary Jesus Makes the News. Will it be drugs? Will it be gays? Will it be an unwieldy sex scandal featuring seedy hotels, bad cologne, and grossly detailed text messages you never want to read? How about another family values congressman busted for cruising gay chat rooms or hitting on young male pages in the congressional bathroom? That's always heartwarming. Or maybe it'll be another enchanting case of sexual abuse and pedophilia in the Catholic Church. What, is that 2001? Fine, how about 6 decades of child rape and beatings at the hands of countless nuns and priests in Irish Catholic orphanages? Oh, right, that was last year. The Pope slamming birth control in Africa? Megachurch pastors shamelessly fleecing their gullible flock for still more millions? Some spectacular combination of the above? So many choices. What's your pleasure, good reader? Of one thing you can be absolutely certain. Whenever self-righteous Christians make the news, it's going to be embarrassing, sad, sickening, disingenuous, a little dangerous, a lot pitiable, homophobic, frequently, hypocritical, invariably, deeply ignorant of the real teachings of the true mystical renegade anti-authoritarian Jesus, who was about as far from modern Pentecostal evangelical fundamentalism, organized religion worldview, as a vegan from Kansas slaughterhouse? You already know the answer, all of which makes it delightful in that nauseatingly familiar way to read the story about the Northern California evangelicals who repulsive views on homosexuality and curing gay people reportedly helped shape a new violently anti-gay bill in Uganda. Did you see? The New York Times piece about how Ugandan officials took the American evangelicals' beliefs about the best ways to punish evil gays to its natural conclusion, and decided, if all other forcible rehab options fail, it would be perfectly appropriate to simply exterminate the homosexuals. I mean, why not? If it's certifiably evil, if you can't cure it, if it scares the livestock, transmits disease, preys upon young boys, and makes the older men fantasize in dangerous and uneasy ways, if God said it was an abomination, what's the problem? Of course, the radical evangelical in question were, or at least pretended to be, horrified at this practical summation of their views. They immediately wrote panicky letters to Ugandan officials to correct their unfortunate, quote, misinterpretation. As damn well they should have. No, 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 they sort of said. We didn't mean actually kill them. That would be wrong. We simply meant gently, lovingly rehabilitate. You know, drugs, imprisonment, maybe some beatings, public humiliation, brainwashing, genital torture, electroshock therapy, like the Mormons used to do. Barring that, just do what we do in America. Psychologically torment in the form of relentless, crushing guilt. This will make the evil gay feel so suicidally depressed about his perfectly natural desires, his body, his emotions, who he is as a living soul on this planet, he's bound to come around. See, like most major religions of the world, we work to shame the sinner so horribly that if he doesn't kill himself, you'll end up with a fine, completely numb soldier of Christ. But don't actually kill him. Heavens. Ugandan officials, apparently a bit confused about just how this crazy evangelical thing works, agreed to redraft the bill and take out the killing stuff. You extremist Christians are so weird, they seem to say, rolling their eyes. It's a story that folds in nicely with a sad little furor regarding tired old Brit Hume over at Fox News, a slumpy veteran talking head who recently muttered something greatly asinine on the air about Tiger Woods, Buddhism, and converting Tiger to the land of happy fuzzy Christ. Indeed, Hume suggested during the broadcast that Tiger would do well to renounce his sinful ways, pack up his little old temple of Buddhism, and move to sweet Jesus, sweet home Jeezlandia, home of Ted Haggard, Kerry Preejean, and thousands of priests who are no longer allowed to touch children, where all is safe and redemptive, and no one has much sex, and if they do, it's certainly not very much fun. It doesn't last more than 90 seconds in the dark in a congressional bathroom. Okay, we're about out of time. We'll end with his final paragraph. Never forget to be thankful, humble pilgrim, that you stumble across barbed tails like this. The times have changed. They're changing. Keep right on changing, usually for the better. In other words, as dire or inane as these stories may seem, offer a moment of heaping divine gratitude that it's not like it used to be. And with any luck, it never will be again. Hell, you can bet even Jesus is grateful for that. That's Mark Morford writing in the Chronicle. Washington, D.C. This is the Borowitz Report. Responding to the botched terrorism attempt on board Delta Flight 235 from Amsterdam to Detroit, the Department of Homeland Security announced today that it was considering a new rule that would force passengers to fly naked. Quote, they won't be able to hide any powders or liquids and they'll speed right through security, said Homeland Security Director Janet Napolitano. This is a win-win. Anticipating complaints from Chile travelers, she said that the Homeland Security Department would force the airlines to institute a snugglies for purchase plan once the aircraft doors are closed. Mrs. Napolitano expressed no embarrassment at having ignored a warning from the Delta terror suspect's father, made weeks before the terror attempt. Quote, our official policy is that we have to be warned by both the mother and father before taking it seriously. And finally, there's nothing worse than a doctor's receptionist who insists you tell her what's wrong with you. Who insists you tell her what's wrong with you in a room full of other patients. I know most of us have experienced this, and you got to love the way this old guy handled it. A 75-year-old man walked into a crowded waiting room and approached the desk. The receptionist said, yes, sir, what are you seeing the doctor for today? There's something wrong with my dick, he replied. The receptionist became irritated and said, you shouldn't come into a crowded waiting room and say things like that. Why not? You asked me what was wrong and I told you, he said. The receptionist replied, well, you've caused some...